This is the Right Honorable Noraleen Nash, the Buzzkill Institute's first female ambassador to California, welcoming you to hear my Uncle Phil busting myths and taking names today on Professor Buzzkill.
Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here once again, busting myths, taking names, and once again on with your favorite historian, the best historian on the show, the crowning jewel in the Buzzkill Research Institute. That is Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, who's on the line with us talking, and we're talking again about his new book called Breaking Protocol, Female Ambassadors in the United States. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing great, and I'd like to thank my mom for writing your introductory comments.
Oh.
That was very nice of my mom to do that.
Yeah. I got that email at the last minute. This topic is so fascinating, and so many buzzkillers have already said, based on the first part of the first episode in this show, that it opens up so many avenues for understanding, not only in diplomatic and political history, but gender history and women's history and all sorts of social history topics. This is a really important book for people to read.
I appreciate that.
In the first show, we, and of course by we I mean you, went over the six female ambassadors that you analyze in the book. But we didn't have really time for you to draw out some of the broader conclusions that you bring up in the book about them as a group and about the sort of the innovations of having female ambassadors and all the changes that brought about. So if we could start with that, that would be fantastic.
Sure. So first a caveat here. In terms of evidence, as I always like to point out, the plural of anecdote is not data. And the fact that you have... The fact that you have a relatively small sample, just six women, means that, you know, in a way, drawing sweeping generalizations is sort of meaningless, right? It was a small group. There were, like I said, never in this period, so the middle third of the 20th century, which is what my book covers, there were never more than two at once. And today, just for comparison, right now, there are dozens. Right now, I'm going to say it's about 25% of our ambassadors are female. So it's sort of night and day. And to generalize, they typically occupied, as I said in the first episode, typically occupied minor posts in Northern Europe, sort of stable, safe, gender progressive, unimportant allies. Unimportant, of course, that's in quotation marks. Unimportant in the view of Washington. Obviously, those were all important countries. Yeah. So notice, for example, that through today, one country has had more women sent to it by the United States as ambassador than any other, and that's Luxembourg, seven times. We have sent women to Luxembourg seven times.
And if I were
in Luxembourg, I would probably notice that pattern, right?
and I suppose a cynic would say this is kind of, well, no progress or not much progress.
Right. Correct. In other words, and in some ways, the period I cover, you can argue that this is more a story of continuity rather than change. Huh. But having said that, if you peel back the labels a little bit and look a little more carefully, I argue, you actually do see some change. For example, if you start to see women, even though the numbers are small and sort of stable in a way, women are sent to allies rather than just neutrals. In the case of Luce going to Italy, they're sent to major allies, not just minor allies.
This is Claire Booth Luce, who we talked about.
Claire Booth Luce, right? Or if you look at Eugenie Anderson being sent behind the Iron Curtain, that's another taboo that falls, right? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. John Foster Dulles in the mid-50s, someone said, why don't we send Willis to Poland? He's like, no, absolutely not. Well, a few years later, Anderson goes to Bulgaria. And then finally, we have Asia included, not just Europe.
Right.
Francis Willis, and also speaking of Willis, they come to include at least one career foreign service officer, not just political appointees. So once again, even though the sample is small, you see one by one these sort of taboos fall by the wayside. As it becomes less controversial, as the women sort of demonstrate their ability, sort of in sort of at the level of sort of the underlying tone or the environment makes it more and more, even though the numbers don't grow, it's more and more sort of routine to send women.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, one by one, these taboos get broken. So I would argue that that's some, at least some limited progress.
Yeah, and I think the taboos is a big is the perfect word to use, because as you talked about in the first episode, there were so many taboos about, they can't get married, they're hysterical, they can't do serious work, they can't keep secrets, right. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and I actually have one of the most telling memos I found is a 1955 memo from Eisenhower to Dulles. And they're talking about appointing another woman who didn't actually end up being appointed anywhere, but he basically says, if we can find some place, you know, one of the northern European countries or Holland or someplace like that where a woman could sort of effectively serve. And so in black and white, he's basically saying, here's the taboo. This is the very short list of acceptable posts for women. Wow. You know, that's one of those memos when you find in the archive, it's like, well, thank you.
Yeah,
President right. Eisenhower, as a historian, can I thank you for writing this memo? Because it really makes my job so much easier.
So Eisenhower said that to Dulles, or Dulles said it
yes,
to Eisenhower.
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And he's basically in writing, admitting what I already knew was true, which is the list of possible posts for women in their head is a very, very short one. It's a very limited one, and it's basically Northern Europe. And there he is basically spelling it out.
So does that mean we can conclude something about the presidents who picked these women?
Sure. We're talking about four presidents. So Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, the four presidents in this period. I'm here to tell you, this just in, none of these men were feminists.
This just in.
this just in. I hope I didn't shatter any illusions out there. None of these men were feminists. And by that, I'm not just cracking wise. These are men who do not on their own assign any importance to opening up new fields to women and appointing women. Yeah, you know, at some basic level, they want to make some female appointments to satisfy women in their political parties. Yeah, obviously there's something like that. You know, Eisenhower appointed a woman to the cabinet. You do slowly have other turning points or watersheds in the appointment of women through this period. But these are presidents who all had to be lobbied.
Political
pressure had to be applied to them, whether it's Eleanor Roosevelt or Molly Dewson or India Edwards under Truman, or even some men like Hubert Humphrey. These presidents had, you know, and that's how this works. This is about politics. And, you know, when someone from your party is elected president, you try to get an appointment and you push for your people. And some of the people who were pushed for were women. And without that lobbying, this would not have happened. And once again, like I said, the fact that we have this highly political process, this very imperfect democracy of ours, it actually works out in this sense. Because the fact that we have political appointments and that we have these patronage jobs actually helps. If you had left it to the Foreign Service and just checked in with them every few years, so should we appoint a woman yet? I'm here to tell you that would have taken until the 1970s.
You sort of alluded to that in the first episode because you said in most other countries it's a career thing. So you have to work your way all the way up over decades to get to
that.
That's
right. Yeah. Okay. Right. And then it's going to be, you know, unless you have like the legislature pushing for a new sort of design of your foreign ministry. You know, you leave the career diplomats, they're, you know, this is one of the last parts of the federal government to sort of integrate when it comes to sex, is what I'm saying here. And but the fact that you've got this weird sort of very American, highly political system with, you know, patronage jobs actually greatly accelerates the process. And so that's in sort of like good news coming out of bad news, I guess is what I would say.
Well, yeah.
Yep.
And I imagine there are a lot of buzzkillers out there since we're in this episode, we're talking about, you know, these broad conclusions. You know, were these good ambassadors? Were they rated at the time? Did people say, okay, now look, this is a perfect example of why we needed to do this earlier because they're all fine? Or was it a mixture? Right. What was it?
That's a great question. Rarely do we have documents that clear when it comes to rating. Mm-hmm. We have some. My argument is that even the worst of them, who I would argue is Pearl Mester, even Pearl Mester was good enough. And so they range from good enough to brilliant.
Brilliant is pretty brilliant.
Yeah, someone like Dean Acheson, once again, not a feminist, he basically argued that Eugenie Anderson was one of the two best appointments he ever made.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
You know, and he was Secretary of State for what? For 4 years, probably. Yeah. Couple hundred diplomats worked for him running embassies, so that's pretty impressive. So I would argue they range between moderately successful and superb. Mesta, I would argue, had a lot of baggage. She had faced a lot of opposition, but even with her obstacles, I think she did pretty well. She was not taken very seriously by the Luxembourg government, which obviously is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. Even in Mestre's case, none of these presidents ever regretted these appointments for a single minute. And,
that's significant.
Let's not forget the first couple, they're an experiment.
Oh,
They're trying out. And by the way, all these women, even those who tried to deny it publicly, all of these women were very, very aware of their place in history. In other words, they felt pressure to perform well, not just for themselves, but for all women. And as Claire Booth Luce said at one point, and I think she's right on the money, she said, if I fail, this is when she's on her way to Italy, she said, if I fail, they won't say she couldn't cut it. They will say women can't cut it. And I think she's absolutely right. I think she's absolutely right on the money with that. But in any case, none of these presidents ever found a reason to discontinue the experiment, and that was absolutely necessary to get to the point where it's no longer an experiment, right? Where it becomes routine. And in my last chapter, I talk about more recent developments, and you know, you really don't have takeoff. In other words, like significant numbers of female ambassadors. Really, you don't see until the 1990s. The slope upward is very, very gradual until you get to the 1990s, and then it becomes much steeper. And by the time you get to the late Obama years, it's about a third. About a third of Obama's appointments are women to ambassadorships, that is. And that actually puts us, I think, number four and number five in the entire world. Around 2016, just for comparison, the worldwide average, by the way, is 15%. It's pretty poor.
It is very poor, yeah.
So even though I would argue we have a lot of long ways to go, we could be a lot worse. But in any case, so these are all women. Five out of the six are amateurs. They all clearly learned well on the job, right? Five out of the six had no diplomatic experience. They had political experience, and that helps.
Right.
But they had no diplomatic experience, so keep that in mind. Willis, who was the one professional, lots of reason to believe that she was better than most of her male peers.
She was
that impressive. And once again, these are women who do all this with obstacles that the men don't have to face. They face sexism. They face press coverage, which on the one hand is typically favorable, but also deeply sexist, as all press coverage was at that time.
Yeah.
They faced obstacles in the State Department. They, in several cases, they're being undermined by their subordinates inside the embassy.
Ooh.
There's a case where Anderson has to put up with her predecessor rolling into town and undermining her in private conversations with all of her subordinates.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and there's a lot of this sort of crap going on that these women have to put up with. And, you know, partly it's because they're political appointees. You can't always completely separate out the motivations.
Yeah.
There's a great book, I think it's called In the Garden of the Beasts. It's about FDR's ambassador to Nazi Germany, William Dodd.
Yeah.
He was undermined by the professionals in the State Department much worse than some of these women were. So this did not only happen to women. If you happen to be a New Dealer who was, excessively anti-Nazi in the view of the State Department, that's why they worked to undermine him, which is, it's an amazing story all its own. But sometimes it's difficult to tease out these motivations on the part of others.
Well, then, in the cases where they were successful, and even those who were sort of, as you say, moderately successful, the sort of specific instances where those moderately successful people were successful, how did they succeed?
How did they succeed? Bunch of ways. One is they typically demonstrated toughness, which obviously is a loaded and even gendered term. But it's an inevitable test, especially when people believe you're not tough enough. Several of them demonstrated physical courage, either in wars or in riots or in crises of various types.
Yeah.
Eugenie Anderson had to be super tough to put up with her hosts in Bulgaria. And we actually have Bulgarians who basically said, wow, we had no idea the Americans were so tough, because they thought she was going to be a pushover. And they found out, to their chagrin, that she was not.
And of course, they're the ones who demanded it. If she's going to make a speech, an address to the Bulgarian people, she'd do it in Bulgarian. And then she pulled it off.
Yeah. And there were other things. She was at an official reception with the president of Bulgaria, and he said some undiplomatic things about the United States. And she just walked out. And it was spur of the moment. And it's funny because at the moment, all of her Western colleagues were also at this reception. They quickly huddled, whisper, 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 and then followed her out. In other words, this was not something you normally did, but they talked it out and decided she had done the right thing. And so they showed solidarity with her, and she got a lot of praise in the press for that. At one article talked about her upstaging a vulgar, which may not show the highest journalistic standards, but I do appreciate the very difficult rhyming scheme. Anyway, so these women in many cases succeeded in some hard negotiations. They successfully coped with some of the problems that were unique to women. So one of the things one of the threads through the book is what I call the spouse issue, which is male diplomats typically were married and then had all sorts of fabulous unpaid assistance from their spouses, which was estimated by one of them as 70 hours of work per week unpaid.
Wow. By the way, first ladies.
Pretty much. And by the way, until the 1970s, if you were a male diplomat, your wife's performance, even though she's not an employee and she's not paid, your wife's performance was part of your official performance review.
Holy cow. Holy cow. And by the way, we should tell Buzzkillers that, of course, as most of the veterans know, that, you know, you prepare outlines for these shows and everything. And so I love to point out some of your fantastic phrases. And one of them here in this section, you say, diplo spouses. So diplomatic spouses are now diplo spouses.
Diplo spouses, yeah.
From now to the end of time. And you say, of course, that's absolutely critical, as you just said.
Yeah, absolutely crucial. No, and there's actually some others, some of my colleagues have written some very, very, very good articles about this issue, about how important an effective spouse is to a successful ambassador doing his job. And so the thing is, especially with the women who were widows and even those who weren't, they do not have the traditional spouse. You know, someone like Henry Luce, even though he allegedly spends 6 months of every year working out of Time Magazine's Rome office so he can be with his wife, he is not a traditional, he's not a host. He's not a very good host. Yeah. And, you know, things like planning social events and doing outreach outside the embassy, et cetera, these are all things that a spouse helps with. So one of the issues I was curious about is how do these women cope? And some of their coping mechanisms are fascinating. For example, Frances Willis, the professional, for a long time in Switzerland and Norway, she had her mother with her living in the embassy. And so her mother basically became a de facto spouse. Promesta relied on one of her sisters to sort of do some of the duties. In addition to the fact that she had an enormous staff that she could afford with her immense wealth. So that's she compensated partly by throwing money at the problem. There were people like Florence Jeffrey Harriman who would do a lot of the spousal duties themselves and then have to worry, well, maybe she didn't know, but then we find out that her deputy chief of mission, her number two in his diary, was criticizing her about shirking her duties as ambassador, as minister. Wow. And it's like, right? It's like basically blaming the victim, right? She didn't have a choice. She had to do a lot of the spousal duties because she had no spouse. So that's one of the things I thread through the book.
Americans will eventually learn when we ever get, you know, join the rest of the world and have a female head of state, what it's like to have a male, for a first man or a first dude, as Sarah Palin famously called her husband in Alaska.
Correct.
So we'll see how well that works out.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, because one of the things that I talk about also is the issues of protocol.
How you
treat an ambassador and his wife, that was all set in stone. And then when a female ambassador comes along, well, that really upsets the apple cart, and it takes years for someone like Eugenie Anderson to get that straightened out, because it becomes another form of sexism, where her husband, you know, back in, I think it's still the case, a spouse of an ambassador enjoys the ambassador's rank for sort of protocol purposes.
Seating at dinner and stuff like that.
Exactly right. And those and precedents and all those issues are actually very, very important in diplomacy. But Eugenie Anderson's person was basically named like a distinguished foreigner or something. He had like no rank at all.
Lordy.
And she had to fight sort of tooth and nail to get that changed. And then she found out toward the end of this sort of episode that some of her own people had been responsible for this. It wasn't just the foreigners.
Wow.
Yeah. So one of the things one of the themes I emphasize most strongly is what Eugenie Anderson called people's diplomacy, which is independent, and it's different from public diplomacy. Public diplomacy these days is an official part of an ambassador's job, right? In other words, sort of outreach to the host country's public, being sort of the public face of the United States in the country, or try to persuade the public, you know, through media events, etc. That really wasn't a thing back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But these women, with the exception of Willis, who once again was a professional, independently of each other, they all see their role as being people to people and not just government to government. In other words, you represent the United States people, the American people, to the Danish people, not just the U.S. government to the Danish government, which may sound obvious.
Right.
But traditional professional diplomats, well past the midpoint of the 20th century, viewed their jobs as you represent your government to their government. That's it.
And also, they're not at ribbon-cutting ceremonies or opening of new schools and stuff. Okay.
You may remember a guy by the name of Daniel Shore.
Yeah.
He had a regular gig on PBS for a long, long time.
He and I go way back.
We're buds. So Daniel Shore was a stringer and went to go cover Pearl Messner in Luxembourg, and he found out that she spent a lot of time traveling around the country. And he, in one of his articles, he wrote that this was very unusual, because most foreign diplomats of whatever country they come from, they generally don't leave Luxembourg City.
No.
And that's the norm in this period. So I argue, long story short, I argue that these women are sort of ahead of their time. Because like I say, these days, that's part of an ambassador's job. But on their own, they saw their job as traveling around the country, getting to know people, you know, especially countries that are democracies. In the Cold War, you want, you know, where people can vote, you want people understanding the United States and having a good feeling about the United States, not just the diplomats and the politicians.
Yeah.
And so they typically traveled very widely where other colleagues would never go. They met folks from all walks of life. Almost all of them tried to learn the language to one extent or another, which was also extremely rare, believe it or not. And I have a great anecdote in the Anderson chapter. I went to the British National Archives, where I found Anderson's counterpart in Copenhagen. He was leaving his office after like 7 years, and his big regret was that he had never learned Danish. And he says in this, it's a secret memo back to London, he says, "You can't understand people without learning their language, and I've failed in this regard."
Wow.
And I thought it was a real interesting counterpoint to someone like Eugenie Anderson, who gives this, I opened the chapter talking about the 4th of July speech she gives in Danish. to a crowd of 30,000 people, and she basically upstages the king. She was such a huge hit. She got the rock star treatment because she had bothered to learn the country's language, and people were just blown away. And so she became a household name in Denmark, and most ambassadors just aren't. These women typically enjoyed immense, even unprecedented popularity in their host countries, and some of them to call them celebrities in some cases is not an exaggeration. It's partly because of the novelty, right? People weren't used to female ambassadors, but it's mainly through people's diplomacy. And so I would argue that it's another aspect of these women's success is that they typically improved grassroots support for the United States in these countries. And once again, they're democracies typically, so it's very, very important.
Absolutely.
You know, if it's a dictatorship, you can make a case, I really don't need to get out very much because these people have no say.
That's right. But if they do...
Then you got to adjust. And professional diplomats were very slow to do that.
Okay, well, Buzzkillers, we need to take a little break right now. But when we do, we're going to talk more. When we come back, I should say, we're going to talk more about the broader impact of these female ambassadors and how important Professor Nash's new book is to the study of diplomatic history. So we'll be back in a moment. Okay, rather than take a sponsorship break, I'd like to take this time to get you Buzzkillers caught up on various things going on here at the Institute. First of all, lots of you are sending in witty, kind, and hilarious audio clips for us to use for episode intros. You'll be hearing them over the next several months. Thanks a ton, and please send more. Tell your friends to record some for us, too. Here's what to do. Record an intro for Professor Buzzkill on your computer or on your phone. Keep it short, one or two sentences, but say what you want. Maybe throw in some Buzzkill catchphrases like crikey or totally stoked. Make fun of me. Make fun of the show. Include your name and use Buzzkill as your last name if you want to assure anonymity. Your hometown and maybe a funny local reference or a piece of local lingo. And of course, don't forget to say something like, here's the Professor Buzzkill History Podcast and Busting Myths and Taking Names. Send the audio file to info@professorbuzzkill.com and we'll get it on the show as soon as we can. Second, I was talking to a friend the other day. I'm helping him start a new podcast, and he asked me how much people would have to pay to subscribe to his podcast. And I said, well, nothing, of course. But I realized that lots of people new to podcasts might not know that. So let me stress that it's free to subscribe to Professor Buzzkill on all platforms, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and all the rest. Free. It's also free to sign up for our newsletter, where we email the episodes to you as they come out. You can sign up for that on the website, professorbuzzkill.com. Free, free, free. Of course, we're totally stoked when people sign up to be patrons of the show via the Patreon link on our website. For as little as $1 a month, you can join Buzzkill Society, receive our popular Man Crush Monday and Woman Crush Wednesday shows, and get a chance to win free copies of some of the books we discuss on the show. So tell everyone that subscribing to the show is totally free everywhere, and that if they want to come see the glories inherent in Buzzkill Society, say that they should become a Patreon member. Now back to the show. Okay, we're back with Professor Philip Nash talking about his new book, Breaking Protocol, Female Ambassadors in the United States. And, you know, this is such a gripping topic, and it's to me, it's so fascinating because it's one of these things that used to seem so old school, diplomatic history. So, you know, as you say, was in the first episode, it's written by about, it's all about communiques and who said what when and what tipped off a world event. But this is so much more interesting because of the layers that you show in terms of what's going on in diplomacy. So I guess my kind of next question is, you know, were these, we talked about this, whether, you know, how much feminism, if you will, there was among the people who were making the appointments. But what about the diplomats themselves? Were they feminists, or where do they fall in the range of feminism?
Right. Yeah, and I think it's a good question, partly because, and you saw this, by the way, there's a great book about female diplomats in Britain called Women of the World.
Oh, that, yeah,
By Helen McCarthy. And she makes the same point that a lot of these women, there was a very popular style of feminism in this period, which was based, I would call it sort of the feminism of denial. In other words,
right.
you don't make a big deal out of it. You don't state your feminism. You sort of act it out. In other words, you just nose to grindstone.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be openly feminist and just sort of demonstrate that you're as good as the men. And you see that in a lot of cases here. You know, someone like Frances Willis, for example, she quickly decided that the way to survive in the career foreign service, where she was pretty much all by herself, she decided that you deny. When everyone ever asks, you always say, her stock phrase was, I've always been discriminated in favor of, not against, basically. I've faced no discrimination. And we know for a fact that's not even remotely true. But right. a lot of them made a decision to play it down. But we know from their letters and their diaries and from a lot of other sources that all of these women, as I may have mentioned earlier, are conscious of and motivated by the feminist implications of their appointments.
Right.
So
right.
Now keep in mind, they all predate second wave feminism that you start to see in the 60s and 70s. They typically were not outspoken, although I should add that the one of the six, the one who most clearly made it an issue was Pearl Mesta.
That's interesting.
She was is there anyone like even close to being an outspoken feminist, it was Pearl Mesta. And so, for example, she was invited to give a speech once in Switzerland, of all places, And she,
because,
and she
of course,
was told,
reminding Buzzkill is that women in Switzerland don't get the vote until
mid-70s. That's right. And, that's right. And this is even before Frances Willis was sent there. So
right.
Pre-1953. And she was told, oh, by the way, in your speech, don't talk about women's issues. And she basically said, well, if I can't talk about women's issues, then I'm going to back out. I'm not going to give this speech.
Yeah.
Which, okay. I think she deserves a little bit of credit for that, because I think a lot of other women in that case wouldn't have acted the same way. So Willis, who, like I said, is the product of the Korea Foreign Service, she scrupulously sidestepped the issue, denied the existence of sexism. I argue that she also deserves a little bit of criticism, because after she retired, she was free to speak her mind and maybe help push for change, and she didn't even do that. In fact, I argue that she wouldn't have approved of the chapter I write about her, and probably wouldn't have approved of the book, which is to say she doesn't think that women deserve any separate attention. They should just be treated as human beings and not as women, which I certainly understand.
But they were
treated different because they're women and so forth. So therefore, we have to have separate books about them.
But she wanted to keep this low-key...
Absolutely right.
Rhetoric about it anyway.
Right, exactly. And she would say, the fact that I'm a woman has absolutely nothing to do with this, whether how good a job I do, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, she was clever. She didn't want to rile any of the men by accusing them all of being sexists, even though it was true.
Yeah.
But if you look at the private evidence, the private letters, the diaries, all of them are highly conscious of the fact that they are pioneers and that mm-hmm. they are... sort of in the spotlight, and they have to perform. And yet, on the other hand, they also typically believe that low-key was the way to go. So I would argue that they are sort of low-key, but very strategic feminists.
Right.
And not of the more outspoken type I think you would have seen, like I said, in the second wave of feminism in the 60s and 70s, where it becomes more commonplace.
Okay, and then what do you think is their sort of impact overall? I mean, it's always difficult to bunch people together over a couple of decades and six different people,
it's worthwhile to generalize to the extent that you can, as I think I said before. Overall, you know, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the trends overall, this is largely a story of continuity. But I make this nuanced argument that there is change within the continuity. These women certainly lay the groundwork for change thereafter. They're sort of an important piece of the puzzle. And as I said, in all of the cases, there's evidence that they helped change the minds, with the possible exception of Mesta, they helped change the minds of the men, including some professionals around them. And so then they become part of this much larger mosaic, right? I mean, how does social change happen? It's the aggregation of individual acts. I mean, to be really obvious about it. And so in the diplomatic world, you know, it's not the only story. There are also other women who are not ambassadors who are helping the change take place and sort of serving on the front lines of diplomacy. But these, I argue, they're an important part of the story. The real the fundamental change comes after this period.
Like
I said, partly because of the broader social change represented by second wave feminism. And then you have reformers inside the State Department, including people like Alison Palmer, who I believe we did a Woman Crush Wednesday on.
That's right, a couple years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. She has actually a book called Diplomat and Priest, because she was also ordained as a priest at one point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She waged a 34-year legal struggle against the State Department to get them to change some of their policies discriminating against women.
34 years.
Yeah, so she was sort of the pit bull in this story, forcing the State Department to change. And like I said, not until the 90s do the numbers go up significantly, but you do have some other breakthroughs. Jean Kirkpatrick, for example, is named ambassador to the United Nations in 1981. That was a major breakthrough.
Yeah.
Appointment by Ronald Reagan. We've had three female secretaries of state now, right? Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice. That's become fairly routine.
And presumably, I mean, a foreign buzzkiller should know that the secretary of state is effectively...
Our
head of all the ambassadors, above or their boss, you know, however you want to put it.
Right. And also we have lots of evidence, like, for example, under Obama, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, first of all, there was some pandering. There were countries that sent women ambassadors to Washington for the first time, because obviously they're trying to suck up. But we also have interviews with some of these women who were just blown away by the fact that the most powerful country in the world would name a woman as their foreign minister, and they said it was very inspirational and helped promote change in their countries too. So we shouldn't underestimate these high-level breakthroughs in terms of their impact. And like I said, Obama's picks in the ambassadorships overall, he appointed about a third of his, not quite, about a third of his appointments were women. Mm-hmm. And you do not nearly see the restrictions that you used to. The things like the marriage ban, obviously, the State Department, kicking and screaming in some cases, does a much better job of promoting gender equity and seeing that women make more progress in the bureaucracy than they did in earlier decades.
So it sounds, you know, a little bit like pace change, but still change and could be considered sort of good news.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, it's night and day in terms of how routine it is for these women. They don't face nearly the setbacks. It's much, for example, there aren't, the men's clubs aren't a thing anymore where the women are excluded, right? That's not an issue anymore. Even some governments that are, or societies that are fairly sexist and patriarchal, a lot of them sort of accept female ambassadors from the United States and other countries without batting an eye. So a lot of things have changed. But as in many other fields, and as we've seen in other fields in recent years, progress is never assured. You can always backslide. And for example, under Donald Trump, the percentage of appointments gone to women has gone down significantly.
Oh, right.
Not just women, but also racial minorities, I should add. I've noticed, in fact, I've just written something for the History News Network about this. I did a little essay where I noted the fact that the Americans have now been represented at the United Nations at the ambassador level by 4 women in a row. And I wonder if that doesn't represent a different form of sexism, whereas to say the fact that we appoint these women to this position and not to a lot of others might not suggest so much that the women are important, but that the UN is unimportant, and that becomes a ghetto for it becomes a ghetto for women. In other words, just like you would send women to small unimportant countries, you send them to the UN. So once again, it's not a huge database, but I just sort of raised the question. There are career women in the State Department, Foreign Service, still have to cope with things like sexual harassment and assault, like women all over the place. The caretaker bias is still a huge issue.
Now, what does caretaker bias actually mean?
Yeah, what it means is that women are also expected to be caretakers of their household and their children, and it means so they can't enjoy the same access and promotion in careers. And so they actually did a systematic study, which I cite, between hundreds of career ambassadors, so all professionals, between, I think, 1993 and 2008.
Yeah,
and they found the women were much more likely to be single than the men, and much more likely to be childless than the men, which is obviously very telling, right? That means that women who are married or have kids don't make it to the ambassador level, and that is what I mean by caretaker bias. Now, by the way, this is a societal problem. You see this throughout the government. You see this throughout industry
and business.
But particularly, I would argue, in the diplomatic corps, because remember, a lot of these are posts overseas, and raising kids and getting them in schools and those sorts of things become much harder. And if, because of caretaker bias, right, if you're the woman and you're supposed to take care of the kids, quote unquote, then that becomes much worse for you. There's still lots of double standards, sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I've got what I think is an interesting section in the conclusion where I sort of take things up to the modern day, where particularly in the diplomatic field, women are caught between these stereotypes. Where, for example, if you are an assertive woman, you're considered school marmish or too aggressive or not a team player.
Yeah.
And if you are shy and reserved and polite, you're considered too soft. You won't be a hard negotiator. You won't be able to get things done, etc.
Yeah, so that's the damned if you do, damned if you do.
Exactly right.
Don't.
Yeah. And in the Women's Action Organization, which is one of these groups inside the State Department pushing for change since the 1970s, they put out a paper in 1980, I believe, a paper on the subject. And the title, I thought, was perfect. The title is, and I'm quoting, "Nice Girl or Pushy Bitch, Two Roads to Non-Promotion."
Oh, non-promotion.
To non-promotion, right? Yeah. In other words, and that's exactly what you were talking about, where it's like, if you're nice, you're a non-entity, but if you're an ice queen, no men are going to be able to deal with you, and so you will never get ahead. And unfortunately, those sorts of double standards, those are extremely difficult to root out.
Yeah.
And to sort of... Yeah. So, in other words, once again, we just like the broader society has a lot of work to do, so does the diplomatic corps. So this, right. I think, we are not out of the woods yet, even though, like I said, in some ways we stack up favorably to a lot of other countries.
But also, as you pointed out in the book, there's this, you know, there's still a lot of historical work to be done. You
know, absolutely.
Your book doesn't answer all the questions, and it opens up its own subfield.
Right, not even close. And that's, like I said, you know, this is old school women's history in the sense that, you know, there are these untold stories, but I would argue that still makes, in other words, this sort of basic sort of factual spade work, a lot of it still has to be done. Really, the only overview of American women in diplomacy was written in the late 1970s for the State Department. And by the way, we have reason to believe that this was partly a public relations move. In other words, it was the State Department commissioning a historian to say, see, we're not that bad on hiring women. Look at all the things women have done in the State Department. And so, my book, I view my book as a beginning, not an end. Like, not even, I mean, it's not false modesty. There's still a lot of work to be done in this field.
I like what you say about basic work, spade work, because I think one of the things that we see so often in the popular media is that history is the past and you can't change it and facts are facts, when in fact, in reality, there are a whole lot of facts out there that we don't know because they haven't been uncovered.
Right, exactly. Right. History is static, right? You're rewriting history, right? Well, one of my favorite pet peeves.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's like not even close, because like you said,
it's never been written before.
There's still these stories that haven't been told, much less analyzed. So,
right. Well, Buzzkillers, it just remains for me to thank Professor Nash once again for coming on the show and enlightening us all.
It is my pleasure. I always enjoy being on, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
And it just leaves me then to say that we will talk to all of you next week.